We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
You're listening to Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5 FM. This is Kabir here in the studio with Steve.
What's up, Toronto? Radio Basics back for another Monday night.
Yes, Steve, after his long departure.
Yes, yes.
From Toronto.
You know, we internationalists, we work all over the world.
So
most importantly, we got to do our work right in our neighborhoods.
Yeah, locally. So we got a good show for you today. We have Nadine Al-Qassem on from Basics Community Newsletter and the May 1st Movement, who's going to be talking to you, giving a message of resistance this Labor Day, as we saw this bootleg fake celebration of what, I don't know what really workers have to celebrate on this Labor Day. Celebrate more layoffs, celebrating more cutbacks and attacks on working class rights. So she's going to be on to give a message on behalf of the May 1st Committee. In addition, we have Elian coming on behalf of the Latin American Solidarity Network here in Toronto, and he's going to be speaking about the ongoing coup d'etat, the military dictatorship that's still in power in Honduras. And finally, towards the end of the show, as high school students prepare to go back to school tomorrow, they're also going to be met with armed police officers in more high schools. So we're going to be having on Alok Primji from No Cops and Justice for Aoi talking about that repressive policy that the Toronto District School Board just recently approved. So right now we're going to Nadine from the May 1st Movement. Hello?
Hi there.
Hello?
Hi there, how are you?
Hey Nadine, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Definitely. So today is Labor Day, and we saw thousands of workers, union bureaucrats, and unemployed, marching in this so-called, really shameful Labor Day parade that started at Nathan Phillips Square and headed towards the CNE exhibition grounds. And of course, looking retrospectively today, being Labor Day, this is a supposed celebration, but workers have very little to celebrate today. I think almost 500,000 more Canadians are unemployed today than they were a year ago. We have, cutoffs, new attacks on the working class taking place. The ruling class using the excuse of the international recession to justify further attacks on workers' rights. Thankfully, however, there were people in today's parade to give messages of resistance and also to link the struggles that workers are facing right here in Canada and Ontario with the struggles that workers are facing internationally in terms of confronting imperialism and struggling for national liberation. So Nadine, can you talk, first of all, just talk to listeners about the May 1st Committee or the May 1st Movement, how it was formed, and basically what its purpose is.
Yes. First, I did want to mention, though, the history of May Day generally and why we think it is very, very important, as opposed to what we know today as Labor Day being the first Monday of September that's celebrated in the United States and Canada and sanctioned by the labor aristocracy and the politicians. The big difference is that May Day was basically designated as the International Day to celebrate workers' struggle in 1889, when the first Congress of the Second International was called. And the reason this day was designated...
And remind people what the Second International was?
It was established after the First International that was organized by Marx, so it was a communist Congress that was organized, and it at one of the decisions at the Congress was to designate May 1st as a day to come together and to celebrate workers' resistance worldwide. And the reason May 1st was chosen was to coincide with the timing of the international protests against the bloody repression of workers in Chicago in 1886. Most people would have heard of this, the Haymarket riots.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do want to mention, though, that the May 1st movement doesn't deny the history of May Day in, Labor Day in Canada. We do recognize that at its origin, Labor Day was called in Canada before it was called in the United States and in Canada on the first Monday of September to commemorate a strike that was put on by typographers in the city and was joined by several other unions who marched to Ottawa and to protest the repression that these strikers were facing by George Brown, who was the owner of the paper Globe and Mail. So we do have a very rich history, but we also have to acknowledge that Labor Day was designated in the first Monday of September to coincide with the American Labor Day, and that was to detract from workers coming together, like in the rest of the world, to commemorate May 1st as the International Day for Workers and to commemorate the Haymarket riots. Yeah. So the reason we believe that May Day should come back and should be celebrated in Canada as well as in the United States, and we have seen several movements of workers now, especially in the United States, celebrating on May 1st and recognize that as the International Day to celebrate workers' struggles. The reason we think that it is important is because we are facing very, very dire circumstances for workers, just like in the rest of the world. And as you had mentioned, we were marching today with workers and organizations representing people, proletarians from all over the world, from the Philippines to Latin America, and they know what it's really like to struggle on May 1st. And they know that it's not just a walk in the park and a parade that ends at a fairground where everyone gets to, you know, come in and go on a Ferris wheel and have fun. So that's why the May 1st movement came together, to recognize this link between international worker struggles and the struggle of workers here in Toronto, and to recognize the fact that we need to come together with everyone else all over the world on May 1st to celebrate workers' resistance and also to recognize the struggle of workers worldwide.
And what was what was people's response to that message today?
At the
march.
To tell you the truth, Kabir, I was actually a little bit disappointed and taken aback in some cases, where you saw labor aristocracy, and what I mean by that were union bigwigs who were marching today in the parade. When they were approached by members of the May 1st movement with information about May Day and information about an event that I'll tell you about that's going to be coming up, a lot of them refused to take the paper. And, you know, some of it, I think, is because of this culture of suspicion that has been built up around, you know, what they see as so-called communist propaganda and calls for the idea that workers' struggles are not just economic, but they're also political. Although this was the case with some people, there were other unionists, members of unions, and workers who were very, very receptive. You know, there's a lot of unions lately who have come under a lot of fire and who have been smeared through the mud in the media. You know, why aren't they going back to work? They're ruining our city, all these things. And a lot of these workers recognize the fact that their struggle wasn't only economic, and that although they see that they made some economic gains in their struggles, they also see that politically, the strikes that have happened over the course of the last little while have been a major blow to the workers' movement. And it doesn't take anyone but a worker to realize this more acutely than, you know, their union bigwigs that are their so-called representatives. So there was a division that we saw today in response to, you know, discussions around the May 1st movement, one being the negative reaction of the labor aristocrats and the positive and receptive reaction of regular everyday workers.
It seemed to me like the most reprehensible act, you know, that really epitomized some of these points that you're speaking to, Nadine, is the fact that Mayor David Miller was invited to speak at the opening rally of the march. And, I mean, we all just endured, you know, a very difficult, labor dispute in the city where Toronto city workers were put out of work. They went out on strike to fight for the concessions that the city was trying to impose on them. And Basics actually just published an article on this issue, precisely that there were some economic successes of the strike, but overall it was a major political defeat because the labor movement, if we can call it such, if we can even call it as such, really failed to come out once again behind, brothers and sisters who were struggling on the front lines in a major labor dispute.
Yeah, and what was really disappointing about having Mayor David Miller there to address the workers was, and this was the CAW actually who had invited him, and I was speaking to some CAW members who were actually quite upset with invitation that was extended to our beloved mayor. I think that we need to recognize the fact that he stood up there and was celebrated by some of the CAW members as being a champion of the worker. And when I spoke to the CAW member, he said to me, you know what? He stood up there and said all the positive things he did for workers. And you know what? He said, okay, I'm going to admit, yes, he did give us some economic concessions here and there. But he was very upset because he said, did he say anything about all of the horrible things that he's done, especially to city workers? Did he say anything about that? Of course not. So it's really, it's a perfect example of how Labor Day today, although it does have a noble history in Canada, is a big farce. And in fact, I do have another little anecdote.
Sure.
One of my fellow May Day or May 1st movement members was just standing in line to go to the washroom talking to some marchers. Mm. And it was really funny. She came out and told me, funny in a sort of morbid way, these women were saying, oh, this is a great march, but really we should have a more festive atmosphere. It should be more like the Santa Claus parade. So really that shows you the extreme way in which the political and even economic demands of workers have been diluted to the point where people really see the parade, just as I have described it on previous occasions, as an occasion to just go out and have some fun. And that is very, very dangerous, and this is especially in these times when we really, really need to come together as workers and really, really struggle, because if we don't, we're going to see similar occurrences to the recent ones that Steve just described with the city workers' strike.
Yeah,
and really, there's nobody to blame here but the leadership of these unions, the ones who are, really not taking up and not encouraging workers to take up a struggle for their economic gains, because really workers have come to expect so little from their leadership that it's almost a given that one is going to be sold out, or one is not going to come out of a collective agreement, a round of bargaining for a collective agreement, with much more than what had than one had last time. For example, Mayor David Miller prattled on and on about how his big claim to fame with labor was that he bought a new fleet of streetcars that were made in Canada, and he was protecting Canadian jobs. It's like, thank you very much, David Miller, for doing the most basic level, administrative functions as a mayor, replacing the TTC fleet with, made in Canada parts and streetcars. Like, thank
and
you very
actually
much.
What,
like, that's
what's,
his extent of his support for labor, or so he spoke to today.
Well, what
but,
support
we have to be wrapping up soon, Nadine.
Yep.
But we wanted to ask you about, we heard that May 1st Movement is going to be having an event in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Can you tell
us
a little bit about that?
I was going to tell you about that, but before I do, I just wanted to acknowledge the fact that May 1st Movement does acknowledge the division between the labor aristocrats and the workers. And so one of our major aims is actually to work with members who are members of unions as well to show them the support that they deserve, that they're not seeing with their current union leaderships, and to sort of show them that there is a international workers movement. And on that end, the May 1st Movement has decided to put together a series of what we're calling May Day schools for class solidarity. And what we want to do with these May Day schools is to educate ourselves and educate workers about the history of May Day worldwide, and also the relationship between workers and other struggles worldwide. So on that note, our first May Day school is going to be taking place this Sunday, September the 27th, 2009. And our first theme is National Liberation and Toronto Workers. Is there a connection? And as you saw this winter, our Tamil brothers and sisters came out in droves and showed how to engage in a massive and powerful demonstration in defense of human rights, in defense of their rights. Mm-hmm. And a parallel to their struggle, although very, very different in nature, of course, that's something we need to recognize. We also see that workers here are coming under fire, and that a lot of people here, although they are workers here and are facing a lot of pressures here, their homelands are also places where people are engaged in massive struggle. So one of the things that have come up in our discussion is this relationship, and we want to sort of explore the link between national liberation struggles mm-hmm. and Toronto workers. What is the link?
So Nadine, can you give us the details, because we have some other...
So I'm going to give you the details right now. The event, once again, is going to be taking place Sunday, September 27th, 2009 at 2:30 p.m., mm-hmm. And the location is QP 4400 offices, so Union Local QP 4400, and that's located at 1482 1482 St. Clair Avenue West. Once mm-hmm. again, this is at 2:30 p.m. And for more information, you can check out the Basics website, or you can email us at mayfirst.toronto@gmail.com.
Well, thanks a lot, sister, for being on the air with us tonight.
Thanks, Nadine.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
We're going to go to commercials quickly, and we're going to come back with Elian from the Latin American Solidarity Network.
Also a QP member, I believe.
Yeah, a member of QP Ontario's International Solidarity Committee.
Right. An exemplary trade unionist. That's right. Radio Basics going to commercials. CHRY 105.5. We'll be back.
Hundreds of thousands of people are living without basic rights, without full status, without having their voices heard. Think it's somewhere else?
It's not. It's right here in Canada. Radio Migrante is a unique space where migrants can voice their concerns, share their stories, and talk about the struggles and resistance that make up their lives. Join us, Maya
and Marco,
every other Wednesday at 4 o'clock for Radio Migrante.
Only on CHRY.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Foster, and you're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM.
Welcome back to Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5. Sorry about that. Just scrambling to get the next interview online. The violently repressive and undemocratic military dictatorship of Roberto Micheletti remains in power in Honduras today, 2 months since a military coup ousted the country's democratically elected president, Manuel Zelaya. Zelaya was abducted from his home at gunpoint in the early morning hours of June 28th by the Honduran military and exiled to San Jose, Costa Rica. The overthrow, which was perpetrated by the Honduran elite, assisted by key members of the American imperialist political establishment, was in response to a number of pro-people policies put in place by the Zelaya government, including the increase of the minimum wage and his alignment with other anti-colonial forces in Latin America, such as Bolivia and Venezuela. The coup government has since imposed a regime of human rights abuses, arbitrary detentions, and targeted assassinations, and has been faced with a massive popular movement demanding the return of Zelaya. Recently, the Latin American Solidarity Network, which is an organization based here in the city, organized a delegation to travel to Honduras and gather information and first-hand reports of the situation and link up with some of the resistance movements that have been courageously waging a fight down there. Today we have on Elian Burbano of the Latin American Solidarity Network and QP Ontario's International Solidarity Committee to talk about the situation in Honduras. Hey Elian, thanks so much for coming on today.
Hi Kabir, thanks for having me on.
Definitely. You were also at the Labor Day March earlier today, as I understand.
Yes, I was. I was there.
Definitely. You heard Miller's speech there.
No, I didn't actually. What did he say?
Oh, you didn't miss much.
Nothing worth repeating.
He's praising himself for ordering his streetcars in Canada.
Yeah. Well, I know that. I mean, I think the CAW invited him. I think what I heard was that the Toronto, New York Region District Labor Council did not allow him to march in the parade.
That's so, right.
Yeah.
Which is a positive move.
Definitely.
So the Latin American Solidarity Network organized this emergency delegation, the Canadian delegation in support of resistance in Honduras. As I understand, the members are just on their way back to Toronto as we speak.
Yeah, they should. They're in transit right now and will be arriving later tonight.
For sure. So how long were they there in Honduras, and what basically what was their what was the purpose of the delegation?
Well, the Latin American Solidarity Network is a coalition of Latin American Canadian solidarity organizations here in the city, and since the coup in June 28th in Honduras, we kind of galvanized, I guess you could say, the organizing of our network. We've organized demonstrations. We've done some pressuring and lobbying with the Harper government, particularly Peter Kent, Minister of State for the Americas. And one of the things that we felt that was very, very urgent was to have a presence on the ground from the international community, particularly because there hasn't been a big presence from Canadian activists, particularly, though, you know, Rights Action, which is a North American NGO, has had a presence, but apart from that, not a lot. So three members of our network went to Honduras. They were there from August 27th, and as I said, they left today. They were primarily in Honduras, the capital, and also spent a few days in the other major city, San Pedro de Sula. And the main objective was to, you know, to be on the ground, to establish links, particularly with the National Front Against the Coup, which is the broad-based movement that is actively and has been actively organizing against the coup for the last 2 months. So they, I know they met, established links with leaders of the National Front against the coup, both people in, coming from the labor movement, from indigenous organizations, from Garifuna, Afro-Honduran organizations, women's organizations. They also took part in some demonstrations that, you know, that are pretty well a daily occurrence, from what I understand, in Honduras. And they also are going to be making like a video report back as well of the experience. And the hope is to, you know, to use that as an organizing tool, but also to use it as a tool to pressure the Canadian government to take an unequivocal stance against the coup regime in Honduras.
Yeah, as I understand, like, I think almost every other country in the Western Hemisphere has you know, condemn the coup to, at least to an extent, in the sense that they you know, not giving recognition to the de facto government, and you know, Harper still refused to cut off aid or military assistance.
Yeah, the Harper government, you know, no government internationally has recognized the coup regime, but the Harper government has kind of followed the lead and the strategy of the U.S. Obama government. So although they did, you know, the Harper government did condemn the coup, as you said, they have refused to enact any form of sanctions.
Yeah.
Canada still has a small military assistance program in Honduras that is still in place. Honduras is the second biggest recipient of aid after Haiti by Canada. They haven't cut off diplomatic relations.
Which tells you something.
Yeah. And apart from that, if you look at kind of the public declarations of the Canadian government, for example, when the coup happened, you know, they, you know, the official statement from Peter Kent's office, they condemned the coup d'etat, but then they went on to call, quote unquote, all parties to show restraint and seek a peaceful resolution to the crisis. So the tendency of the Harper government, obviously following the lead of the Obama U.S. government, is to treat both deposed President Manuel Zelaya and the coup plotters kind of on a similar plane, kind of saying that they, you know, both sides, quote unquote, need to show restraint. The last statement that I've seen officially from the Canadian government, also on Peter Kent's website, comes after was issued August 26th, after Peter Kent was part of an OAS foreign minister's delegation to Honduras. And basically what that statement said is that the Canadian government continues to support the San Jose Accord as the best way forward for national reconciliation. And then they go on to say, or he goes on to say, Peter Kent goes on to say, that Honduras is a quote-unquote deeply divided and polarized society, but there is no mention, and this is something that both the U.S. government and the Canadian government have very purposely avoided to do, is they haven't mentioned, haven't condemned the serious human rights violations. So, you know, instead, as you can see, the Canadian government talks about a kind of a polarized or divided society, but doesn't talk about, you know, there's not like an unequivocal condemnation of the coup regime and the documented human rights violations.
Ilyan, if I may, that the Canadian government has asked all parties at this point to exercise restraint in a situation of military dictatorship. It seems to me that this is basically the Canadian government trying to delegitimize any resistance, any forms of resistance in any and all forms to the coup government, which we see that they're tacitly and to a certain extent supporting, even if they haven't completely recognized the legitimacy of the government. And this reminds me of what happened in Haiti in 2003-2004, where when paramilitary forces were launching and destabilizing and eventually helping carry out and prepare the ground for a coup d'etat in Haiti, which was, of course, culminated when the Canadians, the Americans, the French went into Haiti and kidnapped the president. And it was interesting, leading up to that point, the Canadians were also requesting of Haitians to exercise, all parties to exercise restraint, to seek a peaceful resolution, when clearly what was happening is fascistic paramilitary squads destabilizing the country and then eventually the Canadian government violently intervening. So the question I have is with regard to the Latin American Solidarity Network, among all the work that's being done right now by the network, which do you think has the most success and holds out the most possibility for success? Is it the mass work that's being undertaken amongst the people, amongst Latinos in Canada, and amongst Canadians generally, or is it the lobbying stuff?
Well, I mean, you know, when the coup happened, you know, I mean, first of all, we should mention that Honduras, you know, particularly in the 80s, has a long history of being sort of a base for counterinsurgency in Central America. There's still a U.S. military base in Honduras today. When the coup happened, I think the coup plotters and the military and their tacit supporters internationally, they didn't expect that the popular resistance would be so sustained and so strong. Mm-hmm. And what is happening right now in Honduras is unprecedented in Honduran history, where you have for the last 2 months you have a mass-based popular movement that is peacefully and militantly resisting. They're demanding the reinstatement of President Zelaya, but also they're demanding constitutional reforms to make the country more democratic and more inclusive. So I think who's at the forefront of the struggle is the national coup against the front and the popular movement in Honduras. At the same time, internationally, and those of us here in Canada, I think we have an important role to play, because we have to pressure the government. The Canadian government is playing, they're playing an important role, mm-hmm. in politically and diplomatically supporting the U.S. line and giving the coup regime breathing room, because I think the hope of the U.S., Canadian government and the elites in Honduras, ultimately they do not want constitutional reform to take place in Honduras like it took place in Ecuador, in Venezuela, and in Bolivia. And the hope is that...
And in fact, the day the coup took place, wasn't that done specifically in order to prevent any kind of change to the constitution?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the Zelaya, he wanted to poll the population on whether when the next presidential elections are to take place November 29th. So he was going to do a non-binding poll to ask people in the next elections in November, do you also want to have a vote whether or not you want constitutional reforms? And that's why he was deposed. So I think we do have an important role. I think part of the role is public education, is organizing at the grassroots level. And I think we have a very, very important role in pressuring the Canadian government on its stance in Honduras. Definitely, I think you know, part of the delegation's purpose was to establish links with the Honduran anti-coup popular movement, and you know, and kind of try to support political support for that movement, you know, in Canada, in social movements in Canada, in the labor movement in Canada, and amongst the Latin American community and other communities. This isn't just a concern of the, you know, Latin American community in Canada.
I mean, I think that the models of Haiti and now Honduras in terms of how to, you know, you begin to destabilize and then, you know, overthrow an elected government, right? And eventually, I mean, now we have, as you mentioned, the elections coming up in November 29th. And I'm sure the coup government and, you know, imperialist forces like Canada and the U.S. will, you know, wait for that election to take place, or at least will hope that we can wait for that election to take place in an attempt to, like, you know, legitimize the rule of the military government. Like, this is the same thing that happened in Haiti. And the same thing that happens right now. This is a model that's going to be used, you know, on unfavorable governments throughout the world, in Africa and Asia. So this is, you know, I think that your last statement in terms of that, this is the concern of anybody who doesn't want to see, you know. But I just want to make one, ask you one thing, is if the delegation bore witness to any kind of, violent repression faced by this National Front against the coup? Like, where, did they document any human rights abuses taking place?
I know that they, you know, they interviewed various people. I don't know if they witnessed directly themselves human rights abuses. I also have been kind of in exchange with them just on email maybe a couple of times since they've been away, but they did talk to people regarding documented human rights abuses. So, for example, to date, there have been at least 10 politically motivated killings in Honduras. There's been about 3,500 arbitrary arrests. These have all been confirmed by Amnesty International, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission. At least 20 women in Honduras that were involved in peaceful protests have given testimony that they were raped during their detention. Alternative media have been attacked. There has been torture. There's no dispute that there is repression under the coup regime. I think why the Canadian government or the U.S. government avoids that topic is because if they acknowledge it, even in a limited way, then they'll have to address that issue. That's why it's better to just kind of, you know, avoid it altogether.
Yeah.
I just wanted to also mention that the coup government is pushing forth with elections, presidential elections on November 29th. So it's going to be kind of the next few months are going to be a key period. Celaya was in Washington this past weekend doing a lot of lobbying, meeting with U.S. government officials. And the U.S. State Department, which is interesting, I mean, this is, you know, it's kind of a complicated political game. The U.S. State Department to date still has not categorized what happened in Honduras as technically a coup d'etat, because if they did, they would have to cut all aid and diplomatic ties.
Yeah.
The statement that came out of the U.S. State Department last week was that they are not, under the current conditions, they are not going to recognize the results of the November 29th presidential election. So that's kind of it's a bit of a hit to the coup regime. You know, we kind of have to keep an eye on it to figure out what machinations are also happening behind the scenes. Also, the National Front Against the Coup has you know, they have said that they will boycott that under the current conditions of militarization of the country and human rights violations, conditions aren't there for national elections to take place. So I think the next battleground in the next few months will be kind of the heading into the coup regime is going to push for these elections to go forward, and the popular movement is opposed to the elections. And they're also saying not only do they want restoration of the constitutional order, return of President Zelaya, they are also demanding a constituent assembly and they're using the term to refound, quote unquote, the constitution and the nation, and to which will mean deep structural changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. definitely. You know, it's interesting you mentioned in terms of the Zelaya meeting with Clinton this week, and then, as you said, Obama administration refusing to call it a military coup. They did announce a cutoff of, like, I think $30 million or something, but then concurrently, the IMF gave like $160 million to the Honduran government. So, you know, one hand takes and the other hand gives, you know? Like this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know, you know, I mean, you know, on June 28th, Zelaya was, you know, he was kidnapped by the army. You know, he was put on a plane and he was, you know, expatriated from the country. That's a military coup.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I mean, but, you know, these are...
Eileen, we do... Sorry to interrupt you, but we do have to cut it off there. I just want to ask you quickly if there's going to be any kind of public, if the delegation members are going to have any kind of public event in order to...
Or any other events coming up.
The first thing, next Friday, September 11th, we're part of organizing a demonstration march celebration of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a march against all coups. September 11th, it's commemorating the resistance against what was the coup in Chile in 73, mm-hmm. but it's also bringing in resistance to the coup in Honduras. So there's going to be a march next Friday, September 11th at 7:15. The parting point is going to be Bavia Art Studio, 898 Sinclair Avenue. It's basically Sinclair Avenue West and Oakwood
mm-hmm.
next Friday at 7:15 p.m. And this is going to launch also the Allende Arts Festival.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I want to mention is on Saturday, September 26th, from 1 p.m. to 6 p.m., we're going to have a teach-in, and the delegation that was in Honduras is going to do a report back, and they're hopefully going to have some video material ready. What I'll do is I'll give maybe people our network's website.
Definitely,
all this info isn't up there yet, but it'll be up in the next couple of days. The website is www.rlasn.org.
Definitely, and we'll make sure to post those events on the basic site when they when you guys get out.
Well,
details.
I know that. I mean, one of the members of the delegation, Luis Granados, is a member of Barrio Nuevo, and I know one of his articles was already printed in the newsletter
in the recent issue of Basics. That's
exactly.
Thank you so much, Eileen, for coming on today, and we'll be sure to have to follow this situation in Honduras closely, and hopefully have the members of the delegation on Radio Basics soon as well.
You can, yeah, next, there'll be a soon, starting tomorrow, they'll be available.
Definitely. Thanks so much.
Take care, Kabir. Take care. Thanks.
You too.
That was Eileen Barbano of the International Solidarity Committee of CUPE Ontario, and also of the Latin American Solidarity Network. They're going to be having some events opposing the coup d'etat, launching the Allende festival coming up, and you can Google them, and you can also visit the websites that they gave you, and some of that information will also be on the Basics website, basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com. We're going to be going to commercials. This is Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5. Before that, we're going to be playing a song from R. Kells. They're Hamilton Boys. They recently played at the Frosh Week at University of Toronto. This song is called The Ballad of Hugo Chavez.
Shaw Community Radio.
CHRY 105.5.
My last school is a joke. The same people who control the school system control the prison system and the whole social system ever since slavery.
With some redneck crackers. Right around the time third base dropped the Cactus album, but I was Reed Malcolm. I changed my name in 89, cleaning parts of my brain like a baby nine. I took a history class serious, front row every day of the week, third period. F***ing with the teacher's head, calling them racist. I try to show the crackers some light, they couldn't face it. I got my diploma from a school called Rickers, full of teenage mothers and drug dealing. In the hallways, the popo was always present, searching through niggas' possessions, looking for dope and weapons. Get your lessons. That's what my moms kept stressing. I tried to pay attention, but they classes weren't interesting. They seemed to only glorify the Europeans, claiming Africans was only 3/5 of human beings.
They
Welcome back to Radio Basics, CHRY. That was Day Schools by Dead Prez. A very appropriate track for, as I'm sure any students listening to the show know, tomorrow school starts for high school, middle school, you know, elementary school students. And students will now have another thing to look forward to, along with a year of Eurocentric colonial education. They'll now get to have armed Toronto police officers stationed at their schools. Yes, the SRO program, which was enforced in 30 Toronto public and Catholic schools this past year, primarily in the priority neighborhoods of Toronto, has now been expanded to, I believe, 20 more schools, despite the fact that there has been no public evaluation of this year's pilot program. There's been no communication or consultation with parents, students, and teachers, and even administrators in the affected schools, which is, I think, a standard part of any renewal process for a publicly funded project. Today, we have on the Honorable Alok Premji from No Cops.
And Good evening.
The newly organized coalition opposed to police in schools, a coalition of parents, teachers, and students that all throughout last year was out at schools, out at Western Collegiate, Western Tech, you know, organizing people, organizing students, and you know, documenting students' concerns against the SRO program. So, Alok, what do you think of the extension of the SRO program?
Well, I mean, it's... It's problematic to its very core. I mean, we all know how the program was initiated last year. It was started up by the Toronto Police Services, and the decision in the Toronto District School Board was made at, you know, behind doors at an executive level with very little evaluation and consultation with low-level administrators and communities. As far as this year is concerned, there's already a huge problem in one of the most outspoken communities, that being Jane and Finch, because last November, as we all know, there was a large community forum.
Yeah.
Where majority of community members were overwhelmingly opposed to having police in their schools. Thus, Jane and Finch last year didn't have any police in their schools. However, this year, 9 schools in the Jane and Finch community are having police in their schools. So that, you know, the community's opposition has been overrided.
Definitely. So,
well, if I may just quickly ask, do we have a figure yet for the total number of schools that are going to have cops in them?
No, because I'm not sure at the moment. As Kabir mentioned, 20 more schools. We'll be starting off the year. So that last year there was 31, so that would bring that number up to 51 Catholic and Toronto public schools. But a lot of schools last year, police were not brought in until 6 weeks or 8 weeks into the school.
Yeah.
Because I know schools like North Albion and what's the other one? North Albion and Martin Grove, Thistletown, had consultations which only went as far as the parent councils.
Hmm.
And in those neighborhoods, I mean, it's a mixture of affluent and low income.
And we know what parents are on the parent council.
You know, and as through our work, we know what, for example, Westland Collegiate and Western Tech, whose majority of the youth come from, who are racialized and come from low income communities. However, both those schools and many others like Thistletown have IB programs where, you know, there's whatever, maybe 10% of the school, the youth in that school are in a gifted program. And a lot of the parents in the parent council and student council are a representation of the IB program. So we all know, you know, why those parents wouldn't mind having police in their schools protecting their, you know, up-and-coming university students, children, protected or quote-unquote protected from, you know, the majority of
the hooligans in the rest of the school.
But
honestly, let's not play into the lies. Like, these students are not really there to be protected. It's certain students that are meant to be targeted, right? So we shouldn't galvanize the fears and stoke the fears of those who are fear for other youth in the same schools, right?
Yeah, like, how can, if certain bodies are protected and certain bodies are, that means that everybody's not protected.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know?
Look, one really concerning, it's concerning enough that we have these armed police officers in high schools, and we know the criminalization that already takes place in terms of, if it wasn't enough, students are already being criminalized by their teachers, by the school system itself, without having the police force having a direct hand in their school. But one thing I found out, there was a rally just a little while ago at Jane and Finch in response to the complete overriding of the community's opinion, is that the police in Jane and Finch will not only have access to the high school, but are going to be having access to the middle schools and the elementary schools in the area.
I know, and that's alarming and disgusting, because I was at a Toronto District School Board public meeting on the 25th of August, and one of the trustees, his name was John Hastings, he's a trustee again in North Albion and Thistletown, who's a promoter of the actual SRO program, was actually saying it's great that these police officers are now in the schools and that they're, making their presence felt in middle schools, going around and, you know, trying to display an image of that police in these are great, and that they're there to be guidance counselors and coaches and things like that, that we know police officers are not trained for, and especially are not trained to be in an educational environment. So, I mean, it is alarming, because you know that the Toronto District, the Toronto Police Services have $2 billion somewhat of, you know, a year at their disposal, and they don't have, you know, programs or whatever to place their officers in, so they're putting them wherever they can, subways and buses, you know, schools, now middle schools.
It's criminalization of youth at
such a young age now.
It's probably the only part of the labor force, if you even want to classify police as the labor force, it's the only part of the labor force that's keeping its job, yet they don't have jobs to do.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
It's like, we don't need them, and we're hiring more. It's like the reversal of the whole economic crisis.
It's frustrating. But I mean,
what does that really tell us? What does it tell us that our city is spending more than $1 billion on police at a time when all of the social services are being cut, that we're getting more police in our city, in our schools, and among our youth? Kabir can't stop laughing.
Kabir, control yourself.
What does that tell us about our city?
I mean, that just tells us that there is a prison industrial complex is forming, very similar to what, and becoming very similar to the United States of America. There was a correlation between putting police in schools and the youth super jail that's being built out in Brampton. Because, you know, it's privately, or majority of that jail is privately funded by corporations like Mercedes-Benz and Microsoft. And so, you know, you need, as any corporation, it needs its subjects to produce business and whatnot. So, you know, they need to fill up those cells. And
so Alok, you know, this one of the main criticisms that we had was that the Drone Cops has of the extension of the program was that there was no evaluation or public evaluation. There was no consultation with the community, first of all, but that there is no even evaluation of the so-called pilot program. But however, no cops, people like yourself and myself, were at certain schools throughout the year. And what did what were some of the incidents that we found taking place at these schools that had police officers?
Oh, well, first of all, we had a petition. And in the schools that we took that petition, in each school, we had over 700 students sign that petition saying, we don't want the police officers in our school. And in some cases, we had groups of students actually form together and say, you know, we don't like the police, and in a sugar-coated terminology. But some of the incidents, we had the SRO officers assault two young women and two young men with absolutely unnecessary force, which was captured on cell phone video.
Yeah.
Another incident, another school, was a young 15-year-old male was strip searched in front of his peers on school grounds against the school wall for apparently concealing drugs. And it turned out that there was nothing found on him, and he was strip searched. So, which was also
and I think he was expelled after that too.
He was also expelled. So that's, I mean, I constitute that as rape, a sexual violation. I mean, when you're, no, it's not a laughing matter, but it's, I mean, it's, these are the type of things that the police can get away with. They're almost, it's all institutionally, it's legitimized. And so, yeah, those are some of the incidents. I mean, we had police who, as you know, Kabir, no cops had a meeting with Bill Byrd, who was part of the special programs committee on Toronto's school board, and he said that the SRO officers are there to act as guidance counselors and not as law enforcers. And so I think what needs to be out there is that in the Toronto District School Board there are trustees who are sympathetic to. And to the cause of no cops, that they don't want the SRO program at all. Trustee Mahar and Trustee Rodriguez, who actually proposed for the cancellation of the entire SRO program at the last board meeting, which was amended by the rest of the trustees, saying that there needs to be a further evaluation of the program.
And this was a document that I think that you pointed out was heavily based on no cops analysis of
the
program.
It was. I mean, these two trustees were present at our presentation we did back in June. Yeah. We were only given 5 minutes, and we ended up speaking for 45 minutes, and they had no idea of some of the information that we had collected through our investigation. They were surprised, shockingly surprised. And I mean, but there's trustees like Josh Matlow who have no clue of and are very ignorant to the fact that police target and survey, you know, low-income communities, the priority neighborhoods, at a very and those bodies experience police very differently than people in schools that students that go to North Toronto that Josh Matlow is a trustee at.
Represent.
So he believes that it's building relationships and a new image and a trust between police and youth. However, how can this trust be built in schools when in the neighborhoods youth are targeted, murdered, brutalized, and harassed by police who are there supposedly to serve and protect?
Sugar-coated bullets, you know, sugar-coated bullets. They want to come into the schools, they want to coach the football teams, they want to put on their tutus, they want to dance in the school play.
One more point I would like to make is that there was, and at this TDSB meeting, there was no mention of these two government reports and the one made in the 1990s, the Stephen Lewis report, that was funded by our tax money. Like $3 million of some sort, the Curling and the McCurdy report that, came up with solutions to improve schooling and program and keep kids in school, and that too, the most marginalized youth of them all.
Mm-hmm.
The
whole document,
in that document, did it ever suggest having police in schools? Mm-hmm. And these trustees did not mention it. It's as if they didn't know that this actual report was made.
And in fact, Julian Faulkner even said, not that his, I mean, we go by the experience in terms of the way police behave, the terrorism that they enact on these neighborhoods on a daily basis. But Julian Faulkner himself, who, as you said, was paid our tax dollars to do this investigation, said that this is completely counterproductive, this whole policy.
Yeah. And we know, you and I know, that the wire interaction with some of the SRO officers in the schools that we visited, they are intimidating, they're hostile,
they're arrogant.
They don't believe that their police commit violent crimes or use unnecessary force or even murder. He had no clue who Awie Alnabir is, or Byron Debasis, or maybe he did. He was just concealing it because their code of conduct, gang.
Gang culture.
Aloka, unfortunately, we have to end it here. But thank you so much for coming on today, and definitely
pleasure.
we'll continue as No Cops continues to organize this year. We'll keep up with the situation.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
All right, boys.
All right,
people out there, take care.
All right, easy, bro.
All right.
That was Aloka Premji of the No Cops organization, which is a newly organized coalition opposed to police in schools. I believe you can visit them. I don't know if they have a website, but I know you can hit them up on email at what's the email, Kabir?
Sorry, Steve, I don't have it, but if you go to the basic site, you'll find it.
I think it's nocops09@gmail.com. But just to be safe, go to the basics website, search No Cops, and you'll find it there. And then
we forgot to mention New Basics Up. We have the New Basics issue that came out today.
People got to check it out, in time for Labor Day. No Cops, James Campbell of No Cops, who is a teacher, wrote an incredible article for Basics exposing how little, just as we've been talking about on the show here today, how little Toronto trustees actually know, or the research that's been done around the SR program is very little. And over the last year, measuring the results of success, however you want to analyze success, those statistics haven't been compiled.
And how little they care about the will of their constituents.
Yes. But at the same time, for those trustees out there who are opposed to the SRO program, we salute you. No Cops want your help. They want to work with you. And, just like the people expect that their representatives in all levels of politics are going to be supporting them and representing them. So to those trustees who have come out against the SRO program or who agree with the campaign of the No Cops, salute to you. But it's pretty much the end of our show. Yep. As Kabir said, Basics Community Newsletter, we have a new issue up on our website. You can check it out at basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com. We're going to have a new website coming up in the next couple weeks. It's I know Kabir's looking surprised here. Basicsnews.ca is going to be a new website in a few weeks, but you can always still visit the old site. It'll continue to be posted there. And I don't know, what else?
Yeah, everything that we discussed today is up there. Honduras, Labor Day or a state, you'll find the details of the event up there, from the May 1st committee.
Analysis around the last few strikes that have unfolded in our city. But that's pretty much all the time we got. We're going to go out with a Labor song, also another one from the Arkells. Once again, a Hamilton-based band. They played at Frosh Week for University of Toronto here in Toronto this past week. The song is called Oh, the Boss is Coming.
And this is Kabir and Steve.
Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5. We out.